Today is Thursday, March 21st, 2019. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison, and I'm talking with Patty Scobie, book artist, printmaker, and UW alum. Patty is speaking from just outside of Concord, Michigan, and I'm at the University Archives and Steenbach Library. Patty, would you start out maybe by telling us a little bit about your early life, your family, and where you grew up?
Sure. I'm from a small family. I have one sister, 4 years older than I am. My father was in the Air Force, so we traveled quite a bit. And my parents were both from the Midwest, my mother from South Central Missouri and my father from Tennessee. So being in the Air Force, those Missouri in particular became kind of a base for us when we weren't away out of the country, which we weren't out of the country too much. But between the ages of 10 and 12, we lived in the Philippines. And I have many memories from that time because our parents took us on trips, both in the Philippines, up to the mountains and remote locations, as well as to other countries like Thailand, where I remember seeing statues of the Buddha there. And when we left the Philippines, the Air Force had a deal with an ocean liner company, and they sent us back on an ocean liner, so we spent 21 days crossing the Pacific Ocean. But in contrast to this Air Force life, I spent quite a bit of time on my mother's parents' small farm, and I had many relatives that lived in that area. My grandparents lived a very simple life and grew their own food. They knew how to make and fix things. My grandmother made her own clothes as well as quilts and rugs. My mother was an excellent seamstress as well and taught my sister and me to sew our clothes. She held us up to high standards. If it wasn't perfect, we had to do a redo. And I've often thought learning to sew well and to construct clothes was good training for my work in making books.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember going to museums when I was quite young or really being very aware of art until the third grade. My teacher hung posters of famous artwork up in our classroom. The one I remember being fascinated by was Van Gogh's Starry Night.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was young, my mother took some painting classes. And in those classes, the instructor, it was like at a community center on the Air Force Base, but the instructor would have a book and you would copy from the book. But she was quite skilled. Later, when I was around 13, she enrolled me in a class at the Nelson Atkins Museum in Kansas City that was taught by an artist named Matthew Monks. The class was watercolor, but Matthew taught in a very experimental and inventive way. He took us outside to paint. He took us around the museum. One of my memories is of a room which contained the vacuum, the cleaning equipment for the custodial staff. So we were making watercolors of the vacuum cleaners and the tubes and that sort of thing. I took with him for several years. He was very enthusiastic and encouraging. I hadn't really thought I was good at art before that, but because of him, I took advantage of art classes in high school. By the time I applied to college, I knew I wanted to study art.
And Patty, where did you go to high school?
I went to three high schools because of my father was just retiring from the Air Force. So I went to a high school in Belton, Missouri, and then he was doing a little training in Osawatomie, Kansas. I went to that high school for about a year, and then he did more training outside of Kansas City, and I went to a Shawnee Mission school. So I went from a very small school in Osawatomie my junior year to a very large city school outside of Kansas City.
What was that like, switching schools often while you were, well, in high school, going to three different high schools?
It was hard in high school because you're continually leaving your friends, and of course your friends are so important in high school. The last high school I went to had a lot of art classes, so that was nice for me. But since I was tired of switching schools, I graduated early. I had all my credits and graduated early. So I wasn't that pleased about moving every year.
What kinds of art classes did you take in high school?
Well, in Osawatomie, I took, I think, just a regular art class, but I liked the teacher quite well, and she ended up driving us, myself, and I think she had twin daughters, to the Nelson Museum to take those classes with Mr. Monks. And at the Shawnee Mission School, I had classes like a class in textiles, a class in jewelry making, and maybe a design class or drawing and design, but they were more specific classes there. And it was there that we took a bus one Saturday to the University of Kansas to look at the art department. And that's how I became acquainted with what was offered at University of Kansas for art students.
Could you talk a little bit more about that trip?
I don't know that I can too much
That's
other
okay.
than, yeah, it's been so long ago. I just don't remember. Other than it being big, a big department with, and lively and a lot going on.
Well, what about your experience there then, getting your BFA in painting at the University of Kansas?
Well, that was a good experience. When I began, I took a freshman curriculum, which all freshman art majors took for 1 year, which was 2 and 3D design courses, drawing courses, and art history courses. Until my senior year, the majority of my classes were in painting and drawing. There were quite a number of painting professors, and when I started, they were all men. One woman was hired while I was a student. I remember being a freshman and the seniors coming into our drawing class with a petition to hire a woman. And so I signed it, and they went through with hiring a woman who spent her career there, I believe. So I ended up working with at least seven of the drawing and painting professors. My senior year, I took lithography both semesters with Mike Sims. I really loved drawing on the stones and the printing process, and I knew I wanted to continue printing.
Okay, and then just kind of setting this in time, you finished there in about 1976, is that right?
That's right. I did. When I graduated, I traveled with a friend and fellow art major, Jean Lacluse. We left Kansas and headed for Alaska via the West Coast. We had friends to stay with along the way. We ended up on Kodiak Island, and we worked in the canneries there.
Oh, interesting.
So we got to Alaska, Kodiak, and I think August, and we left in October on the last ferry out before the winter. So I was there with Jean, and then came back and ended up going to Germany, where my sister was living. And I stayed there for a while, and we traveled around quite a bit. visiting Italy and Holland, lots of museums.
And were you doing any art making while you were traveling?
I did do some. Gina and I both would sketch. But I got really involved in keeping a notebook, which was mostly just to record where we were, that sort of thing.
Sure.
But we did both sketch and draw. And in Germany, since I was living at my sister's house, I was set up to do, I think I was doing some watercolor sketches then.
And how long did you stay in Germany?
I think I was there about 3 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when did you decide to apply to UW-Madison for your MFA?
I decided after Germany, I returned to Lawrence. And there I was working for a while as a technical illustrator for pharmaceutical chemistry at KU. I could use the litho shop on campus. Mike Sims was still teaching, and I think I registered for a credit with him or something. And during that time I met Tim Moore, who was studying sculpture at KU. He works with wood. We ended up getting married, and we moved to Minnesota.
Okay.
While I was living there, I bought a combination etching and litho press, and I was working in a restaurant and decided to apply for grad school in printmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be 1979 or 80.
And did you, where else did you apply? Did you apply at other programs?
I did. I had always heard about the UW program being excellent, but the woman who took the litho job at KU after Mike recommended to me that I apply to UW and four other schools.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to five, and all of these schools were in cities where it seemed possible Tim could find work while I was a student.
Mm-hmm.
In early 1981, I visited Madison. Books by Walter Hamady students were on display in the hallway. Immediately, when I saw those books, I knew I wanted to go to graduate school there.
Okay.
At that time, I was working in series, and my work was narrative. I had been giving my prints very long titles, and books seemed perfect to me. So because of that, Madison became my top choice, even though I didn't know very much about the professors. My ideas were just based on the reputation that I'd always heard about, and then that visit that where I was so taken by the work in the hallway.
Did you meet any of the instructors or students while you were visiting Madison?
I did meet with one instructor. I went to the art office, and I think that maybe it just wasn't the right day for some instructors. So, they were at a meeting or something. But the silkscreen instructor, Dean Meeker, was there, so I met with him, and I had my portfolio with me, and he looked over my work, and so we had a chat, and I might have talked to a couple of students in the hallway too.
Mm-hmm.
I was there. I had come over with a friend from Minnesota. So, but I didn't ever end up taking any classes from Dean Meeker.
Okay. Well, when you did end up getting the acceptance and coming to Madison, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what you thought of Madison when you finally were here to be in the program.
Well, I love Madison. Through friends, we found a small house to rent on Willie Street, near Dickinson Street. It was right next to Ace Hardware.
Okay.
And it's not there anymore. It's a little garden center now, if you know that area.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah. So I loved being able to walk, you know, to the co-op and restaurants, and also I walked or biked from home to school, you know, living between the lakes was really great, and discovering like Native American mounds in some of the parks around was, you know, just fun to come across that sort of thing.
And what about some of the students in your cohort? Who was there at the time that you were in the program?
Well, Kathy Keene and Ruth Lingen, Walter Tisdale, Bonnie Stoliker were there, and in printmaking, Gail Haken and Catherine Wild, Tom Hancock, Art Worker, and some of those people didn't really cross over into the book world, but
okay.
Yeah, I was sort of in both worlds from the beginning of the bookshop and the intaglio shop in particular.
Now, what were your impressions of the art department, and I guess those two departments, or two departments within departments that you were participating in?
Well, I began in the summer of 1981,
mm-hmm.
And I just happened to begin by taking a beginning etching with Warrington Colescott and a class with Walter Hamady, and it was a quiet time to begin, and that was nice for me. Since my background was primarily in painting, I felt I had a tremendous amount to learn. I did meet a few students that summer. Stephanie Newman, who worked in Walter's print shop, kind of sought me out since I was new.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the fall semester started, it all felt very lively. I also felt I was impressed with the camaraderie and the atmosphere of collaboration, as well as the generosity of my fellow students. I was impressed because many of them had extensive backgrounds in printmaking already. I was 27 when I started. I thought I would be old, and I wasn't at all old to be starting grad school. Most people were about my age. Some were in their 40s, and just a couple people seemed to have come right out of undergrad school.
Okay.
So I was right there in the middle, but I was impressed by how many students there were in printmaking, and by how many print shops there were and print instructors, and the great equipment.
And Patty, do you recall which class you took with Walter over the summer when you started?
It was called Print Illustration. I don't remember him ever teaching it again. Maybe it was an experiment. I'm not sure. But we talked about books and illustration and printing methods.
Okay. And then what were some of the other courses and instructors that you ended up studying with?
I studied with Warrington and Walter almost every semester.
Mm-hmm.
I studied with Ray Gleckler several semesters. Fran Myers was a sabbatical replacement for Warrington, and I studied with her. Joe Wilfer was for Walter. I studied with him.
Mm-hmm.
Then I I took independent study with Suzanne Slavik, who was in the painting and drawing department, and did drawings with her. I also took from Pat Fennell, who was in the painting and drawing department, and I think I took a seminar from her.
And how did you feel the painting courses were compared to your experience at the University of Kansas?
Well, it was an independent study. So,
oh, okay, got
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Suzanne and I were meeting just in my studio and talking about my work. And with Pat, I've tried to remember, I sort of think it was like a seminar on professional development, and we each gave talks about our work, so that was good. And we might have had work up and critiqued work, something like that. And I could be a little wrong in my memory on that class. But I think I was interested in working with women, and they were willing to work with me.
And you were an assistant for Warrington Colescott, too, is that right?
Yes, for a year, Warrington and Walter had a project grant to make a book titled Since Man Began to Eat Himself. I drove out to Warrington's home once a week to print, and he was great to work with, and I loved it. It was an honor to be with him, and Fran would join us at lunchtime, and we always had delicious food and lively conversation, and he was just a very gracious individual.
And can you talk a little bit about the book that you were working on?
Sure. Warrington made etchings for the book, and there are a number of authors. There are two stories, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, Kenneth Bernard, and four poems, Allen Ginsberg, Toby Olson, Jerome Rothenberg, and Joel Oppenheimer. So we were printing with Warrington, we were printing the etchings. And some of them are a little, his illustrations are a little, they depict kind of lusty people. And he had a great sense of humor. He would tell me to, you know, not look at what I was doing while I was working on it. So we worked on that, I think, for about a year. And then Walter took we did the etchings first, and then Walter printed the type after that.
And what was it like working with Walter?
Well, Walter would really come out at the end of the day to check on our progress sometimes. Definitely not every time. I would think he only came out a few times, and I think the chancellor might have come out once too. That might have been Art Hovey, maybe. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but yeah. So it would be a kind of more social event.
Okay.
You know, and they would come out, and we would be done printing for the day. So Walter was really leaving the etching up to Warrington with me assisting him.
Okay. And what was he like in class?
Well, in class, he was a big storyteller, and often quite enthusiastic. I found I could get a lot of instruction from him if I would sketch out what I had done when I was working on my own, like my lockup in the Vandercook, and when I was a beginning type student, and I would bring my sketch in to see what I had done wrong, and he would tell me right away. And I think he kind of got a kick out of my crazy lockups that I needed to learn more about that. And oftentimes I would put my work up in a empty drawing room and take him in there and have him look at what I was working on so that I could get some feedback from him.
Mm-hmm.
He was very supportive of both my work in, or all my work, I would say, in type and books, as well as the prints and the drawings that I was making. Even though my work, I didn't become a typographer that's able to set, you know, long pieces of writing, but he respected that. He also asked me to illustrate a book, which I felt like was quite an honor and indicated to me that I was taken seriously. It was a poem by Joel Oppenheimer.
And what was the title of that book?
That is Notes Toward the Definition of David. I made a simple woodcut that's printed in black.
And before we kind of focus more on some of your own books, is there anything that you want to add about this time, about studying at the UW?
Well, I neglected to mention I did take the history of books and printing with Val Mae Finster, that was taught through the library school.
Okay.
And she was a wonderful teacher, and it sort of sparked my interest, which has continued, in the history of books. And one semester on Saturdays, I took bookbinding with Jim Dast at his home. I think Jim served a very important function for us that were wanted to make books in terms of, you know, teaching us step by step, and I believe he made efforts to teach in a way that the art students could use.
Do you remember who was in your bookbinding class with Jim? I mean, the class that he taught in his house?
It was a mix. I remember an undergraduate, Amy Unger, and Beth Grabowski was there. There were just a handful of us. The other class that I should mention, my second year, I participated in the seminar Walter led that culminated in the exhibit, Breaking the Bindings.
Okay, yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your participation in that?
Yes. I think that was quite an experience that encouraged me towards, you know, continuing in books. We had money from the graduate school to travel, and people traveled where they had connections. I ended up traveling with Ruth Lingen because we both had some Midwest connections.
Mm-hmm.
And we went to Iowa City, where we met with Kim Merker, Kay Amert, and Bonnie O'Connell. We went to Vermilion, South Dakota, where Ruth had gone to school. And in Omaha, Nebraska, we met Harry Duncan. We also went to Kansas City and Lawrence, Kansas. So we had that trip. And then the process of receiving, we received some slides, so we looked at book work through the slides, but we encouraged people to send the actual work if they could. So the process of being able to see all the variety of work done across the United States by so many different people was wonderful and eye-opening. Also, we were the jurors, so that was interesting that we had to vote. We each had one vote, including Walter. He only had one vote. Mm-hmm. So just that as a group, we had to decide on who was in and who was out.
And Patty, can you clarify, when you were going on this trip, was it just to kind of start meeting people and soliciting submissions?
Yes, I think we were, I think in Iowa City, you know, we went to each Kay Amert's and Kim Merker's print shops. They had separate print shops, and I think we were meeting with them, seeing their situation and telling them about our exhibit and encouraging people to send work, apply for the exhibit. And I think the other person we met with was the Coffee House Press. I can't think of his name right now. So some of those people did send work and some didn't, but it was getting the word out about what we were doing and looking at their work in several cases, depending on what they wanted to do, what they had time for. And so some work came in, and of course then it got voted on by the group in terms of whether or not it ended up in the exhibit.
Were there any particular books that you were really advocating for, or do you recall any of the specifics?
There was one situation where in Lawrence, Kansas, the undergrad, or the teacher for Intaglio and his wife had made an ambitious book that I liked, and Ruth did as well. So that book, it seemed like there was a divide. It seemed like, and it lost out. But there seemed to be a divide about it for some reason.
Well, would you like to talk a little bit about some of your books now?
Sure. I'm taking sips of water because I'm getting a little...
Oh, yeah. Well, we can take a break, too, if you need to.
What's that?
We can take a break anytime that you like, too, so just let me know.
Okay, we might need to, but right now I'm okay. Okay, well...
Would you like to talk? Thinking of one in particular?
I was just going to start with the first book that I made, which is Beyond Reason. That was in 1982. When I first began, I was very taken with the idea of making everything myself, the paper, the prints, and binding. So that book, I had made some woodcuts, a series of woodcuts in Ray's beginning relief printing class. So I had this series of related images I wanted to work out into a book, and Kathy Keene and Ruth Lingen, who both knew so much more than I did, helped me figure it out. And I printed on some of my own handmade paper and Gompy paper, and was able to make my first book. And then I continued and was in Walter's beginning type class, and that's where I made Into Unknown Territories. So I was working in Warrington's class and making all the etchings and incorporating type with those etchings. For that book, I made quite a plan, and I continued to do that for books, making either a pencil drawing plan or a watercolor plan until I made The Back of Time. And I sort of changed my way of working after that. And then for this book, Into Unknown Territories, I had been looking at my past. I mentioned that we'd taken the ocean liner back from the Philippines when I was 12. Mm-hmm. And when I was 22, I was with Jean on the ferry going to Alaska. I began to see both of those points as transformative points in my life. And I started making work intentionally about journeys and transformation. So I was looking at nautical books to get some imagery there, and combining that with other books. I was looking at books of animals. In particular, I really liked drawing chameleons and crocodiles and alligators then. The other book that I was looking at was about the Japanese Bunraku puppetry. There's a cloaked figure, human figure, all in black, behind the puppet, controlling the puppet. And I began using that cloaked figure that's kind of cocoon-like, mm-hmm. in my work quite a bit at that time. I also had looked at pictures of dancers from India doing traditional dances with hand gestures, and I was doing a lot with having those cloaked images that were inspired by the Bunraku puppetry have various hand gestures. So I sort of combining various things with this early work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You mentioned that you used your own handmade paper in Beyond Reason. When did you start making paper?
I am pretty sure I took paper my first fall there.
Okay.
So that'll be the fall of 1981. And then I think I continued to use the paper mill most semesters. I might not have been enrolled in it every semester and not used it for a semester here or there, but in general, I continued to make paper.
Did you make your paper with, I imagine that it was intended for your books and your prints. What kind of paper were you interested in making?
I was interested in making paper to print on,
mm-hmm.
and then using, mostly used, rags,
mm-hmm.
So white or off-white rags for the paper to print images on, and then colored rags to make a cover paper.
Okay. So, I'm sorry, I kind of interrupted you there. You were talking about journeys and transformation and some of the images in your work. You also use birds, it seems, a lot in your books. Could you talk a little bit about that choice?
Yes. I think I began using birds, a combination. I began using them as thinking of them as a seer or a messenger and a protector and a guide.
Mm-hmm.
And I also did that little book I illustrated for Susie Schneider where it's a bird in the hand. So I had a lot of little wood engravings in that book that contained bird images.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of coincided with using it in other work. And then later, I use the bird again, thinking of the bird as a seer or observer. And then even later, in a large print series, Points of View, I have birds flying through all the prints, and then that project, I can describe in a few minutes, ended up being a big folding screen. There's birds flying under the narrative, and I saw that as a rhythm or a heartbeat. The birds making a rhythm or a heartbeat to accompany a narrative.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure when exactly what. I think in my, actually in my prints, some of my early etchings, I was using the bird like sort of sitting on a figure's shoulder as a protector, the idea that the bird was a protector.
Okay. Well, Patty, I know that you worked on Mining of the Heart, and I think that was published in 1986, and you also, you had mentioned that Walter Tisdale was in your cohort, and I know he, I think he printed that one, right?
Yes, yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about how you guys worked on that book together?
Right. I'm trying to locate my note here on that.
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. Yeah, Walter was interested in making a visual book. He is such an excellent typographer already.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to explore that more and asked me to collaborate. So he was really the designer, printer, binder, and publisher. He came up with the accordion structure, which is based on a structure that Haiti Kyle developed. It's a variation on that. And he made a dummy and determined, you know, the sizes. I think maybe we determined it together. I don't quite remember the size that we would work in. And then for each page, I made a watercolor study.
Okay.
And then I did kind of a color separation on tracing paper of the red, yellow, blue, and black to determine the blocks. I cut the key block for the black run out of cherry, and then the color, the color runs, red, yellow, blue, were cut from linoleum. And Walter and I did end up doing some of the printing together.
Okay.
I can't remember if we did all of it or just some of it or what, but he did the constructing of the book. He ended up doing two variations on the binding. One solution has a print going up across the cover, and the other one he's has a spine piece that slips in, which is closer to Haiti Kyle's original, the binding that we were inspired by.
And I think, were you both done with school at that time? Were you, or were you still, I think you had graduated by then, right?
Yes, I graduated. I was living in Madison. I graduated in 84, and I moved in 87.
Okay.
So I had a little studio right down from my house on Willie Street. It I think it might be a little junk store now. It was a little storefront that was just a two doors down, I think, that I worked in. So that's where I was making my cuts. And I had my press there. I had stored my press while I was a student and got it back from my parents' basement. So I was working, set up there to print. And Walter may have still been in school, because we used one of the presses in the letterpress shop, the Vandercook 219.
Okay.
And so I suspect he was still taking some credits at that time.
And I'm curious, so he came up with kind of the structure. How did you work out the content? Like, did he see something of yours that he kind of asked you to do more of, or how did you decide that?
Well, he was familiar with my work.
Mm-hmm.
In general, yeah. So he knew my work, and he didn't ask me to come up with anything specific. I think it was just to be woodcuts and all printed on the Vandercook.
Okay.
But in terms of the imagery, he didn't give me any restrictions or guidance.
Sure.
So it was, you know, from my point of view, it was quite a gift, you know, to have this expert printer offer to work with me on this book.
Is there anything else that you want to add about either that book or maybe any works around that time?
Well, I was going to talk a little bit about the imagery. The I was looking at a book of Ethiopian magic scrolls.
Oh, okay.
At the time, and there are these diamond-faced images, faces within a diamond shape. That repeat throughout the book, and those were inspired by the Ethiopian magic scrolls. And again, here I'm using the birds as a messenger and protector and a guide. And then there's one figure that I use. I might have come up with it for this book. It has a bird on its shoulder, and I am thinking of it as a fire carrier. I had been reading how some cultures would keep a fire alive for many generations and have a person designated to be the fire carrier.
Mm-hmm.
Idea fascinated me. So I've used, at that time I was using a fire carrier character in my work. I also had my son, my first child, in 1983.
Mm-hmm.
So I ultimately think about this book as being about love and the experience of being a new parent and having a new person in my life to love.
And Patty, this book is very colorful too, and a lot of your books are, you know, have this vivid color. Could you talk maybe a little bit about, you know, how you developed your sense of color?
Well, in this particular book, Walter was really, I'd forgotten this till you asked, he was really the one who asked that we do like a red, yellow, blue, black printing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, and my watercolor, I'm not sure if he asked it before I made the watercolors or if he saw my watercolors and he just thought that would be a good way to go. But I think that my color sense maybe originated even with that early class with Mr. Monks in Kansas City at the Nelson. He would bring these big sheets of paper from his, he was an art director at a lithography company, printing company, like commercial lithography. So he had access to these huge sheets of paper. He'd bring that and he'd bring some watercolors, but he'd also bring food coloring, and we'd paint with food coloring sometimes.
Oh, interesting.
So that may be a connection there with that color sensibility.
Thank you. That's really interesting. I wouldn't have thought to use food coloring.
Yeah.
What about, is there another book that you'd like to talk about in particular, anything that you want to discuss now?
We could talk briefly maybe about internal change.
Okay.
Number one, that one, the story is just kind of humorous because I had been real frustrated with my work I was making. I was out of grad school and I wanted to change, and so since my right hand wasn't drawing very well, I'm right-handed, I decided to make a drawing with my left hand. And so I made a dummy for a book and all with my left hand, and then I ended up submitting it for a grant to the Women's Studio Workshop in Rosendale, New York. And I got the grant. So I thought, oh no, I drew this with my left hand. Now what will I do? But I ended, by that time, my instructor, Mike Sims, from undergrad, wasn't teaching, but had his own litho shop to print work for other people, called the Lawrence Lithography Workshop. So I used my grant money to print with Mike. And I did, actually, for the book, I stayed true to my dummy, but I used my right hand for all the drawing. And again, I did the color separation, like I had done with Mining of the Heart, and separated the colors out on tracing paper and then translated, used that as a guide to draw on the stones and the plates. But Mike did the printing onto my handmade paper, and I did the constructing for that book. So it was great to be able to return to Lawrence for a little bit and work with my first litho teacher.
Yeah, I bet that was really nice. So that was finished in 1988, is that right?
Right, in 1988. And so I got that grant, and I also got a grant from the Michigan Council for the Arts to do a series of intaglio prints, 2 feet by 3 feet, which I titled Points of View. So I had this series of 10 prints. Walter Tisdale introduced me to Dan Kelm with the idea that Dan might figure out how to present that series. Dan came up with a solution that is 6 feet tall and 20 feet long. It can be displayed in a variety of ways, an accordion fold, a wave form, or a circle. I've almost always shown it as a circle. So for the viewer, it's as though they are walking into and becoming enveloped by the narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So my original prints are on the top of these panels, and because of Dan's solution, I had to make more prints. So I have a repeating and connecting image on the bottom that I was saying earlier is birds to accompany the narrative above as a heartbeat. And then on the outside, so the inside of the screen is very light, and the outside is quite dark, and those prints are, they're the bird prints again, printed in a different way on the top. They're wiped intaglio and relief, surface rolled black. And all the prints on the inside are wiped intaglio, so a lot more papers coming, white of the papers coming through.
Mm-hmm.
And the bottom on the back is boat imagery, just tiny boats. So again, I'm working with the idea of a journey in this print and or this series, and shifts in physical and psychological perspective. So that was what I was finishing when I started to think about working on the back of time.
Okay. And then could you tell us a little bit about that book? It has a unique structure, so maybe you could kind of describe the structure first.
Sure. Well, when Steve Clay of Granary Books asked me if I wanted to work with him, he said that he would have somebody bind the book that I made, and that he'd been using Dan Kelm. Well, that was perfect for me because I had worked with Dan on the points of view. As well, I had taken a workshop with him on the wire edge binding. So as I thought about the book, Steve had told me I could do anything I wanted to, which is really pretty intimidating. somebody gives you their confidence and trust, and but he wasn't in a hurry, so I had time to think about it. And I often begin these bigger projects by sitting and thinking with no real goal, but a stack of notepaper next to me. So on one of these notes, I wondered, what does the front of time look like? And on another one, what does the back of time look like? And on another, I wrote the structure of change, because nothing is ever still. So once I had made these notes and I had made those thoughts, I had an idea about a title, The Back of Time, and I started having ideas about the structure. For a long time, I wanted to make a book with no beginning and no end. I thought this might be the time to try. So I had the idea of it having the wire edge binding on both sides and being connected to the middle and opening up with a crack. And I talked to Dan on the phone, and we sort of worked the concept, you know, how it would work on the phone. And he said, well, I can draw me a line, and I'll have the crack done with a laser cutter. And his only request is, don't make the line real pointy, otherwise the pages won't turn well. So I went out to the woods and looked at rocks that were cracked, and drew a line that I thought of as a cracking line. So I was thinking of my viewer going through the book and it being as though they were going through a moment of transformation. And it's after the book was all done and people saw it, they said, oh, I like that profile that you have the book opening with. Well, I had never seen the line as a profile, although I can see it now. What my viewer sees, I had just seen the crack as a crack. So it's always instructive what your viewers will tell you they see. Changes the way you see things. So that's how the structure evolved. Go ahead.
I was just curious, how did you connect with Steve at Granary Books?
Well, that was through Wisconsin, because Steve was in Minnesota when I was in Wisconsin. And Walter Hamady knew him, as well as Kathy Keene, I'm sure, and Walter Tisdale already had made books, and Steve had sold them for them, I believe. So then I was introduced to Steve through them, and he had sold several books for me. I think he had all the editioned books I had made up until that time.
Okay.
So he had sold quite a few Mining of the Heart books, and he moved to New York about around the time I moved to Michigan, probably. So I met with him when I was in New York, and that's when he asked me he had started making these books, publishing these books with artists. So that's when he asked me if I'd be interested.
And did Kathy Keene also play a role in The Back of Time?
Absolutely. Steve had said he would pay for a printer, and he asked if Kathy Keene might be someone I could work with. And actually, was the main person I could imagine working with, because she and I printed together as a team on each other's prints when we were in school. And we both liked to get up early and be at the print shop when nobody was there yet, and we would take turns auditioning each other's work. So I knew she knew how I worked, and I knew how she worked. So she came out twice, and I would say for 2 to 3 weeks each time, maybe even 4 weeks one time, and stayed with us and printed.
That brings to mind a question of how long this project took, because it seems like it's pretty complicated and you're talking about multiple visits. Do you recall, like, how long you were working on this book?
3 years.
3 years.
You're right, yes, because there was the printing. So to print, I was surface rolling an etched plate and dropping stencils into it each time. When it comes off the press, it's the dark black mm-hmm. and white. Then the next step was to watercolor and do the pen and ink work. Then the little shapes that are attached, that I call them shard shapes, those are a separate plate. So those were all printed and cut and attached with a dry mount tool. So then at that point, once the drawing, watercolor and drawing was done, pages got sent out to Dan to construct. So I would send groups of pages out at a time.
Okay.
It was, figuring the book out was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I love to print, so that was fun. And the drawing, I had been worried, you know, oh, what if I can't do, like, the drawing for 25 copies? But it was very relaxing. So each step was a different kind of work. But I just going to the studio and knowing I was going to draw on more pages was just pleasurable work for me. I work really slowly, so... And I also was teaching workshops at the time, so it's not as though I was only working on this book the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two kids, so my kids were young. My son was born in 1983, and my daughter in 89. So,
okay.
Yeah, when I did internal change number one, when I was doing that drawing, I was pregnant with her.
So. And Patty, where were you teaching workshops? Were you teaching them in kind of in your local area or elsewhere?
Well, in Madison, before I moved, I had started working as an artist in residence in the schools a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came here to Michigan with that background. And I got lined up through a program that was countywide, I think. The office was in Battle Creek, I think. I can't remember the organization. But they lined me up with various schools. So I would go for a period of time, depending on what the school had contracted for, a day or a week, and work with the kids in the school. So this was all ages. And it must have been, I know I went into Dearborn and closer to Detroit a little bit too. So that might have been through another organization. So these were, we'll say, like within an hour or two that when I was working with kids in the school. I had a residency in some of the little towns around here, like semester-long residencies in Albion and a little town called Homer, where I might have worked for a year, a semester or a year, depending on the grant.
And what was it like teaching art to children?
Well, I was a guest, so I was special. So that was very nice. And I made, at that time, too, you know, in the 80s, late 80s, not as many people knew about making books. So they were doing this for the first time. And I also made paper with them. The making paper was great in that I had 100% success rate with happiness. They all loved it and were all very happy with their paper. That was hard work, though, for me, because we're hauling paper pulp in and out. And then I did bookmaking as well as printmaking with them. I really, working with the kids freed me up to do things even more experimentally than I already had a tendency to work, just seeing them work. There's a place in Ann Arbor called the Scrap Box that sells scrap from industry, and I think it's probably from the auto industry that I would get these sheets of kind of a foamy material that had adhesive and paper on the back, so kids could actually cut a shape and take the adhesive off and attach it to a piece of cardboard and then roll it up and print. So it was fun and instructive to watch them work. And then with books, it seems like even in Detroit, once I was at a high school, and when I first got there, the students were eyeing me like, oh, who's this? And so but I would see a transformation sometimes where they would be pretty jaded, and then they would make a book and forget to be cool and get really happy about their book. So that was quite rewarding too. And the best compliment I ever got was from a little boy who asked me to come out and play at recess. I had been a big hit. He wanted to play with me on the playground.
That's very sweet.
So I enjoyed working with all the ages, and my opportunities sort of gradually changed to where I was being asked to do more, you know, specific workshops on basically the way I work, I think, with adults. So it wasn't really intentional. It was just sort of gradual that I began working with adults more.
And what kind of students come to those workshops? Are they pretty, like, advanced students already that they're coming to take a workshop with you?
Well, most of the workshops that I've taught, have had the whole range of students.
Okay.
Like at Haystack, you might have an art professor in your class and Barb Tettenbaum and I have team taught at Haystack, and we're like, oh, I think the students all know more than we do. so they have, you know, they're already very well developed in whatever media they work in, and but also younger people with less experience. Can end up in one of those workshops. I taught for quite a few years in Ann Arbor at a place called Hollander's, which is both a store for paper, selling paper and bookmaking supplies, and they had a school for many years. They took a break from that, and they've reestablished that school. But I taught there fairly regularly, and there I sometimes would have people who had never printed or made a book before in the same class with people who had taken a number of classes with me. So I had to teach what I taught, I intentionally made accessible no matter what level you were at, so it would. You could still challenge yourself if you had more experience, but you could be happy if you had no experience. It ended up that a number of students I worked with at Honders asked me if they could continue working with me in my studio. So that ended up being quite nice. For about 10 years, I think, I had students coming to work with me in the studio. So a few of them I worked with maybe for 10 years. So I really saw their work develop, and I felt I could really speak to what problems they were working on.
Mm-hmm.
They were people with jobs. One was a therapist full-time, and another was an elementary teacher. Those two used to come together. So they were working with me on the weekends, but quite serious about learning and what they made. So that was quite rewarding.
Were they working on book projects or more prints?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I would try to get an idea of what they wanted to do the day they were coming. But oftentimes, from the time they wrote to the email to the time they arrived, they had changed their mind. So we would usually sit down and they would tell me what they wanted to work on that day, and we would just go from there.
Okay. This is reminding me, too, that you had at least one class at Woodland Pattern in Milwaukee, and I know a lot of the UW students in the art department had a connection to Woodland Pattern. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about that store?
Sure. That was a very important part of our lives when we lived in Madison, going to Woodland Pattern and having going to poetry readings there and getting to know Carl and Anne. Kathy Keene and I had a show there at some point,
mm-hmm.
in probably the 80s. And then later, in 2000, in the early 2000s, the first decade sometime, maybe 2005, I went to Milwaukee for a week, I think, and taught some workshops there as part of a grant-funded project that Anne Kingsbury had written a grant for, and I had a show at that time, too. So, the connection continues. I just saw Anne and Carl last year, and so they were important people.
Okay, thank you. I'm also curious, you mentioned working with children. Did you teach your own children printmaking and bookmaking? Were they interested in that?
Yes, they were. We did quite a bit. My studio is separate from my house, and so I had a little spot for them to work, and they both did quite a bit there. My daughter maybe continued doing more than my son when she liked to write a lot, and she would make books and want to make whatever book I was learning to make, she'd want to make that too.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and as a freshman started working in special collections and worked there for 7 years. So,
oh, wow.
She's quite a book lover.
Is she still working in special collections?
She's not. Her husband went to library school, and they ended up at UW-Platteville. He works in the library there, and she works in the public library in Platteville.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, you're familiar with where that is. It's like 20 minutes from Dubuque over near the river.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And my son actually ended up in Madison. He works for Epic Systems.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So
you still have connection to this area.
Very strong connections, yeah. Yeah, I almost thought, oh, I should just go over, you know, and have the interview with you, but the timing wasn't quite right for me to come over.
Oh yeah, no worries. This is great. Was there anything that you wanted to add, kind of either about teaching, or we kind of started with before that, we were talking about the back of time. Is there anything that you want to touch on either with teaching or the book?
Yeah. I had quite a bit more about the book.
Yeah,
yeah. Since it was such a big project. I'll just start with how I began after I had the idea of the structure and had talked it through with Dan. I just started by following hunches and vague notions, and I didn't even know how I would use them, but I made three large intaglio plates, and two of them ended up being the background plates for the main book and then the wrapper, and the third plate was the plate that contained the shards that I cut up and collaged. When I made the background plate for the book, I was just drawing on the plate tiny scribbly gestural lines that to me represented a vibrational field, sound or music. Then for the shard plate, I had referred back to the prints I made for the Point of View series and extracted images from there to draw within those shapes, and sometimes wrote text in those shapes. Those shapes were, I drew those from broken pottery.
Oh, interesting.
Then once I experimented with rolling these plates up, and I started by dropping stencils in, torn paper, mylar, and string, and then I worked back into those areas that were left white after I printed them, so that I could see was my working method. And then I began to develop the idea for the actual pages just through thumbnail sketches. And printed from those. Before I started on this book, my husband's sister had died unexpectedly. And when that happened, time seemed to change for a while. And that affected, that idea of time changing and being different than your regular life affected me and led me to this book. I think of it as it refers to a moment of clarity or a glimpse, and an assembling of an image, an accumulation of information, and repeated shifting and the cracking of that illusion or image. I also, one of the things I'd been reading was Sacred Geometry by Robert Lawler, and I had noted the moment itself of transformation from one state to another, from one quality of being to another, from one form or level of consciousness to another, is always a leap or jump, an incomprehensible velocity, as it were, outside of time, as when one cell divides into two. So I came up with the idea of the number of pages, 8 pages or 7 intervals, thinking about cycles of change or a musical octave, and the spectrum of light on a lunar month. Then I was thinking of that page in the middle that links the two sides as the heart of the book. So I thought of my viewer as entering the circle on one side, and each time the pages turn, the square gets bigger and the circle gets bigger. So I was thinking of sending my viewer through that circle, and then they pass through the pages and get to the heart of the book, and there's the labyrinth. And then I close the book, turn the book over, and enter the labyrinth. And again, repeat through those phases and get to the center of the book, and it's the circle. So I also had a little bit of text through the book. On that one side where you reach the labyrinth, the text reads, "Lost with the poet," and on the other side it reads, "Given secrets." So working on this book, developing the project, both technical shifts occurred in my work, because I was no longer working with making the image all in one plate or one block.
Mm-hmm.
I was manipulating, you know, just having a big surface and then manipulating what the resulting image was with these stencils. So my approach to printing changed. It really became more of a drawing process at the press.
Okay.
And that's when I quit making extensive preliminary drawings.
Mm-hmm.
And started printing in a much more spontaneous way. I look back at this book from time to time, and sometimes I intentionally have used things like some of the phrases as titles for projects, like Under Falling Questions, which became a book, and Broken Time, which became a book, are both on little shard shapes in this book. And now, for quite some time, I've been working on an ongoing project that I think of as Lost with the Poets. It's kind of all circling back.
Patty, I wonder if you could also talk a little bit about kind of the container. It's not a container. I forgot what word you used that kind of envelops the book, because it opens in both directions.
Right. Well, once we made this, Steve's original plan was to make a box,
mm-hmm.
have Jill Jevney make a box for the book, which she did. But because of the cracks on both sides, he was worried about getting it out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So we came up with the idea of making the wrapper. So that was at the end, and then the wrapper could be the title and the colophon. So I'm pretty sure I made the wrapper last.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Jill did make the nice boxes for the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you wanted to touch on?
I think that's good.
Okay. Well, I wonder if we could kind of talk a little bit about Hyde, which is a very small circular book, and it has a very, I think it makes for an intimate experience with the reader because of the size. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that developed and why you chose to make a book the size that you did.
Yes. Well, I had made Under Falling Questions, I had editioned that. That was a long-term project. And I had done another book that there's only one copy of, titled X, but it's 3 feet tall. And it's, when you open it all the way, it's 2 feet by 3 feet. It's got two spines with little pamphlets going up and down the spine. So I had done those two big projects. So Hyde was kind of an antidote to working on these longer term, bigger projects. So there, I made an edition of 25 variants. So each book is different, but some things are common throughout the 25, the size, and I was using scraps from these other projects. So the heavier paper in the book is scraps from X.
Mm-hmm.
I think the end sheets are scraps from Underfalling Questions. And then there's some translucent paper that is from just some experimental proofing. The shards in it with the text are ones that I didn't use for The Back of Time. I had seen a tiny circular book that was accordion fold in a, like a historical book in an exhibit someplace. And that's when I thought, oh, I'd like to make a circular book. And then the fact that it was little was appealing and intimate, as you say. But I don't remember why I decided to do signatures. Maybe because that was the best way to use my scraps and bind it up that way.
Did you want to talk about X or Underfalling Questions?
Could talk a little bit. Underfalling Questions. Again, I was thinking of evoking shifting perceptions by assembling those smaller pages with the bigger ones.
Mm-hmm.
And by this time, I after The Back of Time, I started making linoleum blocks with very simple cuts on them, and was expanding my repertoire of stencils. So I had this vocabulary of stencils to work with, and I had Katie McGregor make paper with an eye watermark. So there's the eye-shaped watermark going throughout the whole book. And then the little torn pieces are paper I made. So this book also, I often am interested in something particular technically when I'm working.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that Katie's paper was super strong because the Library of Congress chose her paper out of a lot of handmade paper for its foldability, to be able to fold it back and forth. So I thought, well, this paper should work pretty well because I'll be folding it and folding it backwards for the printing that I had in mind to do. So I was interested in this printing across the gutter and using the ghost images that would line up. So after you run your print through once and get the first inking off, there's still ink on the block. And you can, if you've used stencils, you can take those stencils off and there will be ink on the stencils and you can turn them over and print with them. And so I wanted to do that too. So when I make a book, it's like I'm figuring out a puzzle, which for me is a lot of fun. But sometimes I get kind of complicated. And for this book, I did have a flow chart when I auditioned so I could remember what goes where.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did that one, and then X was in response to a themed exhibit that the Racine Art Museum, I think it might have been called the Wustum at that time, used to have invitations to themed exhibits, and that particular one was on time and geography.
Okay.
So I just made the one big book, and I thought of all the pages. You might have seen images of the book in like the catalog that I know that UW has
of, mm-hmm.
Rare Beauty. But so on each side there are 9 signatures. And when all the pages are closed, so that there's like would be 18 pages. The image connects, and then you can turn each one. And when you get all the pages turned, there's a new image. But you can also kind of play with juxtaposition of images. So I was interested in it being big so that the viewer would have to lean across and become bodily involved in moving all the pages. And I was interested in this idea of the sequence of the images changing and matching up sometimes and not matching up other times. Let's see, in planning the book, my notes I was writing, measuring rhythm, measure the change, measure the distance, the interval, the measurement of life, the weight of time, timetable of a pathway, charting a course, voices coming in like instruments, branching, pathways, sinuous, shifting. It was the time between. It was on the way from point to point, connection and reappearance.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
Would you like to talk about mourning? I know that one was published in 2008, and it features letterpress printing on some very thin paper and relief prints with vivid colors. Maybe you can talk about kind of the impetus for that book?
Yes. Oftentimes, I have the title first, and the phrase, I took the morning out of my pocket, just are words that came to me. I wasn't doing anything in particular, but I wrote them down and thought I would use them sometime. And I had the idea of the pages folding out with text hidden for some time as well. So when I started this little book, I had little bits of text writing in my notebook that I thought I would use. And I was thinking of voices, so I wanted the text to represent different voices. So there are three voices. The voice that starts and says, trying to turn the page here. The paper is a Japanese paper that my friend Yumiko brought back from Japan, so I was interested in using the qualities of the thin Japanese paper, and I kind of liked that it became hard to turn. But of course, just now when I was trying to turn the page, it was a little frustrating. So the book starts out with, the morning brings questions. And that line is in the middle of the book. And it ends with the text in the middle of the book that says, I will swim with you. So I'm thinking of that voice as my voice. And then the next voice, but who are you? The questioning voice. But who are you? And then where are you? And searching. That voice is a little higher on the page than the first line. And with each question, it gets higher. And I'm just thinking of that as a questioning voice. And then the text in the folds, can't tell, not sure. I'm thinking of that as my father's voice. My father was sick for a long time with cancer, and then he had strokes toward the end of his life. And although he was still himself in some ways, it seemed like I just wondered, where's the person? It seems like this other person is here now. Where is that other person? How does the brain work? How does the brain provide that? And so I'm thinking of these questions, but where are you? And inside thoughts of my father, swimming, searching. For the box. The box of lost words. Words lost in the sea of sadness. And then I will swim with you. So, sort of based on my last visits with my father and And also, I was paralleling it to other experiences with friends who were going through hard times and just becoming really quiet and searching for something. Technically, I'm using the relief rolling and the stencils again. And I was using water-based inks this time. I've used oil-based inks a lot in my work, and I've taught a lot with water-based inks because of the ease of teaching with them. And so I also wanted to make a book that was using the inks I taught with.
And Patty, how did you come up with the idea of having the pages kind of unfold to reveal the text?
When I started making books, I was interested in, you know, playing with the page, having it unfold, and page length, having them short, and so in those, like, into unknown territories, and of course they crack in the back of time. So it was just something that actually, yeah, I'm remembering now, the fold, I think I had just, like, made a little fold by accident and liked the way it pulled out, and that gave me the idea. So a lot of times I just come across something that I do, by, you know, mm-hmm. unintentionally, and then I like it, so I end up using it. And then it became kind of a challenge to figure out, you know, how to print it where I wanted it, and how I wanted the text to be placed and the stencils and everything.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else that you wanted to add about it?
I think that's good.
Okay. Well, I think that we're ready to wrap up here. I just wanted to ask you kind of your final thoughts, maybe how you think the UW impacted your career.
Well, it definitely was a pivotal point for me. I went there with the intention of acquiring skills and techniques in both prints and books, and I did that, which I've continued to build on all these years. My instructors made a big impact, I believe, maybe by their example, to present yourself professionally or how to operate in the professional world. I feel like I left there knowing how to write grants for projects and you know, teach workshops and that sort of thing. I felt prepared
mm-hmm.
For those things. I felt like excellent work was being made all around me by my fellow students, in addition to my professors. But I think of that as being a very high on, you know, the list of the good things about going to UW is while I was there, there was cross-pollination with ideas between students, a sharing of techniques, and connections were begun. And those connections have continued through today for me with people I have remained in contact with, Kathy Keene and Tracy Hahn and Diane Fine and Walter Tisdale and Barb Tettenbaum and Bonnie Stoliker are people I team taught with. And then meeting people through the UW connection, like we talked about Woodland Pattern, but also the poet Jonah Pora, who Kathy Keene and Walter Tisdale and others have printed his work. He was in Ohio at that time and started coming to Madison regularly, and I'm still in contact and see him pretty regularly. So the connections continue to be a big part of my life and just seem wonderfully endless and intertwining. I think of these other UW grads, even if I didn't overlap them with them while I was a student, but they came before or after me, like Diane Fine or Tracy. I think of us all as sharing a common ancestry.
Thank you so much, Patty.
You're welcome. Thank you for the interview and giving me a chance to do it later. This timing was much better for me than it was last spring when you first emailed.
I'm going to stop recording. So today is Friday, April 12th, 2019. I'm Sarah Lang with the Oral History Program at UW-Madison, and I'm talking with Patty Scobie, book artist, printmaker, and UW alum. Patty is speaking from just outside Concord, Michigan, and I'm at the University Archives and Steenbach Library. Patty, last time we talked about your time here at the UW, but we didn't get a chance to talk too much about your husband, Tim Moore, and his bookbinding tools that he developed and how that related to your work. Would you be able to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, I would like to. My attending UW was pivotal for Tim's life and work, as well as my own, because I worked with Walter Hamady and because of the enthusiastic papermaking and book arts community thriving there. Tim found his niche for his career, making paper molds and bookbinding equipment, and he's made an important contribution to the field of book arts. I really don't believe that would have happened had I attended a different school. I wanted to talk about how I became interested in paper making. That happened when I was still in Lawrence, Kansas.
Okay.
Kathy and Hallie Clark of Twin Rocker came to KU and gave a workshop I attended. I also went to a lecture Tim Barrett gave at KU around that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very interested in paper. Like me, Tim Moore, not Tim Barrett, mm-hmm. had attended the University of Kansas. As a student there, he was already an accomplished woodworker and majored in sculpture. He finished his degree in the spring of 1979. We got married and moved to Minnesota that fall. While we were living there, we had the 1978 Dover edition of the 1943 Dart Hunter book, Paper Making, the History and Technique of an Ancient Craft. We used the description and illustrations in that book, and we set about making a paper mold together. We built the frame and began weaving a surface by hand, but didn't finish it. However, this experience and effort prepared Tim for his later endeavors. I started school, like we talked about before, the summer of 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Right away, when I met Walter Hamady, he asked me a lot of questions about myself, as well as questions about Tim. I brought a small frame print with me that day to show Walter. Tim had made the frame, and Walter loved it.
And Patty, can you tell us a little bit about the context of this? Was this when you were meeting Walter for a class, or was this before a class started?
I think back in those days, maybe we went in, maybe because it was summer session too, we went into the class and met the instructor and signed up for the class.
Okay.
I think that's why I brought the print with me, was I wanted to sign up
mm-hmm.
for the class. My memory's a little fuzzy, but I think maybe he was offering papermaking and the print illustration class I described before, but he talked me into the print illustration class because he needed students for that.
Okay.
Yeah. And at that time, Tim had a job working on a Kohler Foundation restoration project in the village of Valton. That's about an hour and a half northwest of Madison. His job that summer was to work on stabilizing a simple frame building that houses murals painted by Ernest Hoopenden, who was an itinerant painter and worked on these paintings 1897 or 8 through 99. These paintings depict the rites and symbols of the modern woodmen of America who owned the building at that time and asked Hoopenden to make the paintings. That building is called the Painted Forest.
Interesting.
Yeah, it's currently owned by Edgewood College, and I think it might be a little bit of a retreat center for them. So it was the fall of 1981 that I took my first papermaking class with Walter. And by that time, I think Tim had already been out to his house to fix some things. One day he brought a two-on mold from Britain to class and asked if I thought Tim would be able to cut it down to make two molds. The two-on mold is a very long and narrow mold that makes two sheets of paper at a time. So Tim did cut this down and created two molds and made a decal for the molds. And these were to be used and were used by the students in the art department's paper mill. So I think Walter really recognized Tim's attention to detail and woodworking, and I suspect that he felt that paralleled his own attention to detail and working with type. So a little bit later, Kitty Kingston, who was a graduate of UW, decided to set up a paper mill in Madison. Walter suggested that Kitty contact Tim about making molds. Initially, Kitty had a kit for a mold that she had Tim put together. Next, she asked him to make a lathe mold. Tim began to research molds. He had already been to Appleton, Wisconsin, with me on a field trip Walter organized for the papermaking students. And it was, you know, fairly casual back then. Tim often got invited throughout my graduate days to go on field trips with my classes, and if he was free, he would do it. In Appleton, we toured the Appleton Mills, which is a felt-making factory, J.J. Plank, which makes dandy rolls, and the Dart Hunter Museum at the Institute of Paper Chemistry. The museum had examples of historic molds that Dart Hunter had collected.
Okay.
So in preparation for making Kitty's mold, we returned to the museum in Appleton so Tim could study the construction of the molds there. He also examined the British molds in Walter's collection. Then I'm not sure exactly when Joe Wilfer replaced Walter, but he was an additional resource for Tim and knew about an important book for Tim to reference that was published in the Netherlands called Paper Mold and Mold Maker. So while Tim was doing this research on the construction, he couldn't find a source for purchasing backing wire or a good source for purchasing lathe surfaces for molds.
Can I interrupt you just for a minute? For
sure.
People who don't know what a mold and decal is, can you like just briefly describe it?
Yes. It's a tool for making paper. The mold part has a wooden frame construction with ribs and a wire surface, which is either laid or wove, is attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
There are ribs running along between the frame, the edges of the frame, and then the wire surface is sewn to the ribs. The deco is a frame-like object that goes on the outside of the mold, and that holds the paper pulp in while you're making the paper. So then you remove that deco when you get ready to couch or transfer the paper pulp from the mold to a paper-making felt.
Great, thank you.
So Tim decided to build a loom for weaving these surfaces that he couldn't find.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned when we previously talked, we live next to Ace Hardware on Willie Street. And owner Bob Shepherd was also our landlord. We had an account there, which was very handy while Tim was designing and building the loom. He was able to go to Ace, get parts that might work on the loom, and if they weren't right, he could run back over and switch them out for something else to try. He also had to find wire to make these, and Lee Scott McDonald, who was making molds at that time, was a generous and helpful resource for obtaining wire. At some point, Tim finished the loom and could weave a lathe surface on it and was able to make this mold for Kitty. Word about making the mold soon spread, and early on he made molds for Jenny Frederick, Peter Thomas, and Tim Barrett. At that time, the paper-making organization, the Friends of Dart Hunter, which was started in 1975 by Joe Wilfer, met every fall in Appleton. Tim attended a couple of these meetings, and at one gave a presentation about making the molds.
Mm-hmm.
And before one of those meetings, we had a group of people traveling through that included Tim Barrett and Paul Robert, Lee Scott McDonald, stopping by our house. And other friends from the Madison papermaking group came as well, and we all made pizza together, and then the travelers went on to Appleton that night. Tim and I came up later for the meeting. And this became kind of a pattern throughout our lives where people that were passing through have stopped by our house and studio to see Tim's studio and work or my studio and work. And in this way, I feel as though we've reinforced each other's connections and work, and friendships have developed, and you know, enriching our community of people in our fields.
Mm-hmm.
So it was in May 1983 that Kathy Clark of Twin Rocker, which is in Brookston, Indiana, and her sister Peggy Prentice were in Madison to see the Breaking the Bindings exhibit. Peggy had a book in the exhibit, and they had heard about Tim's efforts.
Mm-hmm.
I came home from school one day, and Kathy and Peggy were there, and I think, I'm pretty sure it was Kathy Keene and maybe Walter Tisdale who had brought them over to talk to Tim about molds. It was at that time Kathy Clark invited us to come visit them in Brookston. She and her husband, Howie, who made beaters for papermaking, were very generous with their time and offered us valuable suggestions about being self-employed. Peggy, who's Kathy's twin sister, also a papermaker, lived in Brookston at that time. And we were introduced to Barb Tettenbaum there, even though she went to UW as well. She was an undergrad before I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew about her work, and I'd seen her work in Walter's class, but I hadn't been introduced to her until then. She was there using the letterpress equipment for about a year or so, sort of, I'm not sure if it was quite an internship or what. So since that time, Tim has made many more molds, including a number for Twin Rocker, and he's used that first loom for many years. A few years ago, he made some improvements on it and has a new loom now. And at this point, he continues to think about ways to improve molds, and he tries his ideas out on experimental molds. A little bit more than being interested in making molds to sell, in the last few years, he's been interested in passing on this knowledge he's accumulated from his research and practice to people who are interested in making their own molds or molds for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So in recent years, we've had several people come visit us for a few days to learn from him. And a couple of these people, Claudine Latron, who lives in France, and Serge Perard, are both making molds. And then the other, well, and James Kleiner, who works at Cave Paper, may be making his own mold. Kimmy Martin and Carrie Cushman also came. And I have overlaps with some of these people. For example, Kimmy had taken a workshop with Barb Tettenbaum at me at Pinland. And then years later, when I was in Brooklyn and New York and walked into Pace Prints to see Ruth Lingen, Kimmy was there working on a paper piece. So while I was there, she asked about the possibility of coming out to learn how Tim's loom works. And then after a year or so, she did come for a few days to learn from him. So these overlaps have been very interesting as they occur.
Patty, when people are coming to learn from Tim, are some of those artists also then working with you on any projects? Has that happened?
That hasn't really happened yet.
Okay.
Kimmy and I did talk about that, because we do have a little paper-making setup in the basement of our studio. But Kimmy and Claudine and James and Carrie are all artists.
Mm-hmm.
But usually, most often, people who come to visit me want to see Tim's shop and are very interested, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of reinforces that for each of us. So in terms of passing on the knowledge, Tim's written a couple of articles for two issues of the Hand Papermaking Journal, and has an appendix in Tim Barrett's new book on European hand papermaking.
Okay.
So while I was still a student, Walter had another suggestion for Tim, this time for bookbinding. At that time, Walter used a cradle to nest a signature in while punching sewing holes one by one. He proposed to Tim that he design a tool that would make this process easier and more efficient. So Tim came up with a design called a signature punch.
Mm-hmm.
It quickly and accurately punches these sewing holes a signature at a time. So instead of nesting the signature in the cradle, you put the signature on top of a row of pins, and then there's a bar to bring down, and the pins are pierced all at one time instead of having to pierce them individually.
Mm-hmm.
It also has a little stop, so you can nest the signature at that stop every time, so they're exactly the same from signature to signature. So this has been a very popular tool and used by many hand bookbinders for both small and large editions.
And Tim also developed some other bookbinding tools as well, right?
He did. He designed a tool that Gary Frost, who was in Iowa City at the time, put him up to, called a precision plow. And that machine is for taking off incremental amounts of paper from the edge of a stack of paper or a book. Gary's interest was because he would get these nice art books in that had images across both pages, so across the gutter. But the binding was what they call perfect bound, so it was all the pages were just glued up at the edge.
Mm-hmm.
But then it would fall apart, and Gary wanted to save as much as he could. So the tool he had, he kept wearing out and having to buy new ones. So he suggested to Tim to make something that would last. So he designed that tool, and Gary was quite pleased, and he sold a few of those, although it's a pretty much a specialty tool.
Okay.
And it's, you know, you have to know how to use it to work on it. Actually, he had me use it, and we called me the Chuck Yeager of the precision plow because I blew out the bearings on it while I was using it because I was using it so hard. So he knew he had to make an adjustment. So I kind of test things out. And I joke that since I have access to all these beautiful tools, that I'm the envy of all the book conservators.
Mm-hmm.
So he's also made a variety of finishing presses, and these are presses that were already being made, but he's made them in his own way. And I think because his background in he has that background in sculpture, he brings an aesthetic to his tools that's unique to him. Many times, you know, I've had comments from people that, oh, this is a piece of sculpture, you know, I'm afraid to use it. Of course, they shouldn't be. So this work, I think because he's got that background in sculpture, he really loves the problem solving of his work, and he's been able to do that over the years with this work and develop and refine these tools to be used.
And Patty, you mentioned at the beginning that you didn't think that this would happen without being here. Could you just expand a little bit on that?
Yeah, I think it's because Madison was for us a special place where a number of intersections took place for both of us. But working with Walter Hannity, which, you know, he put Tim up to doing these things, and then the breaking the bindings, bringing Kathy Clark to town, Joe Wilfer being there, and the fact that the Institute of Paper Chemistry was in Appleton at that time, it's now at Georgia Tech, and then the individual groups of students that were there, they got to know Tim and me, and were also interested in his tools. I think all of that combined to be a place where he could make, you know, envision making a living off of making these tools and just gain the knowledge that he needed to. So I feel as though going to another school just wouldn't have had that same combination
mm-hmm.
of things. And and I asked him about this, and he said, yeah, he found his niche there, and he might not have even found a niche elsewhere. And he does have a particular skill set that's, I think, unique to him, and that worked just perfectly for developing the paper molds in particular, although he does really enjoy the other tools. Because he also has the skills to make tools to make tools. So, for example, the signature punch comes with several strips made out of a certain kind of plastic, and they all have holes punched into them, drilled into them is more accurate, at different increments. So the bookbinder can choose from all these different increments. So when he drills those, he sets his drill press up into its own machine so that it's automatically pushing these strips through and drilling the holes.
Okay.
So he has a kind of engineering mind, too, that he could figure that out. And then for the book presses, the finishing presses, like the repair presses and bevel top presses, he makes screws for those, wooden screws. So he's made the tools that have the knives in them to cut the threads for the wooden screws and for the inner part in the block that's the main part of the repair press will have threads inside as well.
Okay.
So I think all these kind of skills that he happens to have are fairly unique to him, and we find that when people come who are interested in making molds, for example, Claudine, who came from France, went back, and she had a friend who helped her make a loom, and she's making the woven parts, and she's having a woodworker make the wooden parts, and then she finishes them off. So is the wire screen paper making surface to the wooden part. So she solved that problem, and which is a good way, I feel, by it being more than one person, the final object.
Well, thank you, Patty. Is there anything that you would like to add that we haven't touched on?
Maybe one brief thing. I had wanted before to mention Julia Miller, who's a conservator and book historian living in Ann Arbor. And she is an example of somebody that Tim and I both met. She owns some of Tim's tools. But what I had wanted to mention before was that she had been a mentor to me. For a year or two, I worked with her about one day a week to learn traditional bookbinding skills. And she's since become a very close friend for both of us and has introduced us to many people she knows in our fields. But having worked with her, I am often working in my studio and I reflect back that I learned what I'm doing from her because she was a trained conservator who became a book historian. And I mentioned that Valmay Finster in the library school at UW was my teacher for the history of books and printing and sparked my interest in the history of books. And Julia has continued just whenever I see her, we talk about various historical books that she's very excited about and that deepens my understanding of books and the history and sort of a tangential interest to me, but also I think an influential one.
Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, you're welcome. Madison, I think that for Tim and I was a very magical time where everything was kind of coming together for us, and I guess we didn't know it would last for the rest of our lives, but we were both able to become self-employed while we were there, and because we were self-employed, we decided to move to Michigan, where Tim's family has some property, and we built a house and studio on that, and that work we began in Madison's continued here in our studios for the past 32 years.
Patty, I'm kind of curious, can you describe the studios a little bit? Like, are they near each other or kind of in the same space? But, like, I just would like to know a little bit more about where you work.
Sure. Our house and studio are two separate buildings, mm-hmm. but next to each other. And the studio is a large two-story building. Tim's woodworking equipment is all on the first floor, and my printmaking equipment's on the second floor.
Okay.
And I have a nice balcony that I can go out on on the second floor. It's nice skylights with northern light. And then in our basement, I mentioned before, we have a little paper mill mm-hmm. that we sort of rescued from a place that was throwing it out. We heard about it and rescued that equipment. So it's set up, and a few people have used it. So I sort of see it as a community service. And there was an artist in residence at Albion College named Amy Lee, who's a Korean paper maker. Hanji is what the Korean paper is called. And while she had a residence, she came out and used the little paper mill.
Oh, nice. Well, I think if there's nothing else, then I'll stop recording.
Okay.